who will give a talk on transference-focused psychotherapy for severe narcissistic personality disorders, recent developments in research and treatment. To start, a few brief administrative details. First, if you are registered for the call-in series, you should have received an email with the slides, so please download the handout now if you haven't already. Second, we'd like to acknowledge the Gunderson residents at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts and the Clearview Treatment Program in Venice, California, who are generously helping to sponsor this program. Then we also hope that individuals on the call will show support for these calls and make a donation of any amount to help continue the call-in series in the future and to ensure that recordings will be made available when you are not able to be on the call. You can do that on our website at borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. Or you can click on the link in the newsletter you receive. You can email your questions throughout the talk to neabpd@aol.com. Again, that's neabpd@aol.com. We will ask questions at the end of the call, and as I said, we might ask questions throughout it if that comes up. Finally, we will finish promptly by 9 p.m. As always, the audio and slides from the call will be archived at www.borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. So please feel free to pass on the link to people in your network who couldn't make it tonight. With that said, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Diana Diamond, who is an associate professor of psychology at the City University of New York and a senior fellow of the Personality Disorders Institute here in New York. She also teaches residents and psych interns at New York Presbyterian Hospital. She completed her clinical psychology doctoral training at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and completed her internship at the Neuropsychiatric Institute of the University of California of Los Angeles, after which she completed a fellowship at the New York University postdoctoral program in psychoanalysis. She has authored many, many peer-reviewed journal articles and books, and she is considered an expert in the field of personality disorders, and it's a real pleasure to have her here. With that, I'd like to thank Diana for donating her time to do this call and for her support of the NEA effort to help further educate the BPD community. Thanks so much, Diana.
Thank you, Elena, for that lovely introduction. I really want to thank you and Perry Hoffman and all the organizers of this NEA BPD Sunday Speaker Series for inviting me to give this talk. It's really an honor to speak to a group of parents and families who have individuals with BPD, as well as to colleagues. I always find that I have much to learn from patients and families as much as they have to learn from us. So I look forward to your comments on this work tonight. So tonight I'm going to talk about two concepts that are usually kept distinct in psychodynamic thinking, and that's narcissism and attachment. I'm going to begin by presenting our object relations conception of narcissistic disorders, which I think is quite different from the DSM view of narcissistic pathology. Then I want to tell you about some research that we've done on attachment patterns of patients with comorbid narcissistic and borderline pathology, and then to present a case showing you how these attachment patterns play out in the clinical situation and help to illuminate the dynamics of NPD-BPD patients. And by the way, I will refer to patients with comorbid narcissistic and borderline pathology as NPD-BPD. Okay, I want to acknowledge my colleagues in the PDI, the Personality Disorders Institute, who have worked on the research and clinical formulations that I'm going to present today. They're too numerous to mention by name because we have a limited amount of time, but the PDI is directed by Otto Kernberg and John Clarkin. Both of them have been instrumental in both the theoretical and research formulations I'm going to present today. There's also a group of international collaborators from Vienna, Munich, who have also contributed to the research that I'm going to talk about today. And these colleagues are listed in the first couple of slides of the PowerPoint. Let me begin with a couple of statements by patients with narcissistic and borderline pathology in transference-focused psychotherapy. I'm angry at you. I've been on the internet reading about NPD, and I don't think you talk enough about my narcissism. That's one patient who had been in NPD treatment with Dr. Frank Yeomans for a couple of years and then began to instruct him about how he should be treating her NPD-BPD pathology. Here's another patient who actually was a patient of mine who was quite a severely suicidal patient, was in a year and a half of inpatient treatment, and then I saw her for approximately 4 or 5 years in the outpatient phase, improved enormously in every way, got married, got a job, et cetera, et cetera. But midway through the treatment, she said to me, I've been getting a lot out of the sessions, and I know I'm much better, but I can't admit it because your success is my failure. And then another patient, a higher functioning patient, said to me, I was in 4 years of analysis and 2 years of psychotherapy before that, and I never learned anything about myself that I didn't already know before. That was a higher functioning patient, and that was said to me early on in the treatment. So let me just say that these are the kinds of statements. All of these were intensive and ultimately very productive treatments, transference-focused psychotherapy treatments, but they highlight the formidable clinical challenges posed by patients who have co-occurring narcissistic and borderline disorders. Their devaluation of therapy, their presentation of self as special and entitled, their tendency to ask for special privileges, and their tendency to provoke, alienate, or even de-skill their therapists, along with their high dropout rate, make these patients particularly difficult to treat. So let me just say that for the past 20 years, a group of us, clinicians and clinical researchers at the Personality Disorders Institute at Weill Cornell Medical College, have been working to develop a manualized psychodynamic treatment for patients with severe personality disorders, and that is transference-focused psychotherapy, which I've been referring to. And our goal has been to study changes in attachment, symptomatology, and mentalization in patients over the course of 1 year of TFP. That's for research purposes only, because most of these patients stay in treatment far longer. And to investigate how different patient characteristics, that is, those who have particular constellations of pathology, like narcissistic with borderline, how these affect the treatment course and outcome. Most recently, we've been working to refine our clinical approach and understand patients with NPD. We have a manual in preparation of TFP for NPD. Let me just say we've been working on two fronts. Those two fronts are a weekly supervision group where we present our patients, and over time, one of the reasons we got involved in doing this work of looking at patients, particularly with NPD, is we realized that as we were presenting cases to each other, that the most difficult patients to work with in the personality disorder spectrum were those who had comorbid NPD and BPD. So through the supervision group that's been ongoing for about 3 years, and then through some specific research techniques or looking at some of our data, re-examining some of our data, we've come to the formulations I'm going to be presenting to you tonight. Let me just describe TFP briefly. It's a twice-weekly individual therapy. it works with a treatment contract, which sets up the frame for the treatment and helps to control symptomatology. It also works with possible adjunctive treatments for eating disorders or substance abuse. The goal is to set a safe frame to control symptoms. The focus is on containing and increasing awareness of intense affects, interpreting contradictory self states and views of others with the view toward improving identity integration. It targets the internal world of mental representations, and in our view, the most important shift, in addition to symptom control, is a shift from fragmented, unintegrated representations of self and other to integrated, coherent, modulated ones. And we believe this happens through reflection on the experience of self and others in the here and now relationship with the therapist. Let me just say again that patients with comorbid NPD-BPD may be among the most difficult to treat of patients in the spectrum of personality disorders. They have a 64% dropout rate. We find they have greater pathology of relatedness than other patients with other personality disorders at comparable levels of severity, even though, and this is the paradox of patients with NPD-BPD, they may seem to function better. That is, some studies have shown that there's fewer hospitalizations in these patients, fewer inpatient days, less severe self-mutilation, and less treatment seeking. So they may look on the surface to be more stable. The second reason that we want to study these patients is they're quite prevalent. So individuals who meet criteria for NPD also meet criteria for BPD in numerous studies, going anywhere from 80% to 38.9% to 17%, depending on the study. In our own research, we find we had one study where 70% of the patients were NPD-BPD patients. Another study, and this is interesting because this is our Vienna-Munich study, we found only 10%, and that's interesting because we wonder if there's a cultural factor here. Are these disorders more prevalent in the United States? And maybe that's something that we can take up, or in North America, that's something we could take up in the discussion. So why are these patients so difficult to treat? We have the activation and the transference of a pathological grandiose self. They tend to provoke, control, devalue, and disengage the therapist, or to idealize the therapist in a fragile way, alternating with shifts to pervasive devaluation. In my view, the reason they're so difficult to treat is because they have extreme difficulty in acknowledging and verbalizing their subjective experience and suffering. That is, these are patients who have tremendous fears of dependency, incompetence, fear exposure. They're quite envious, but they fear just talking about their envy. They have tremendous fear of loss of status and tremendous vulnerability. So we know that narcissistic pathology can present in different ways, and this is one of the things that makes it so difficult to treat. Individuals who suffer from narcissistic disorders can present quite strongly what we call a thick-skinned narcissist. They show verbal fluency, social competence, self-reliance, overt grandiosity. But this often obscures their difficulty in acknowledging and verbalizing their subjective suffering, their internal distress, their feelings of worthlessness and incompetence, their isolation, and their fears of tremendous fears of vulnerability. And then adding to the difficulties in treating these disorders and even recognizing them is that they can manifest themselves in multiple presentations depending on the level of personality organization, subtype, or activated mental state. Another reason why they're so difficult to treat is because of countertransference feelings. So clinicians in one study that was done, and it was a survey of countertransference feelings in individuals, clinicians of all theoretical persuasions treating patients with narcissistic personality disorders, they reported feeling anger, resentment, and dread working with such patients, feeling devalued and criticized by the patient, and finding themselves feeling distracted, avoidant, and wishing to terminate the treatment. Now, it's really surprised me as I've talked to colleagues about doing this work and working with these patients and writing a manual on how to treat these patients, how many of my senior colleagues, experts in treating borderline pathology, have said to me, I don't know how you can treat those patients. I'm always trying to get rid of them. And I think one of the reasons why there is such a high dropout rate with these patients is because clinicians, I think, inadvertently act out in ways that lead the patient to leave treatment, because they find these patients so difficult to treat. Now, why are they so difficult to treat? Grandiosity. This is the best discriminating evidence-based criterion for NPD. You have a slide on this. Elsa Roningstam and John Gunderson and their colleagues have done some studies in which they've shown that grandiosity discriminates patients with NPD from those with BPD and without NPD and antisocial personality disorder in three previous studies. However, we know that grandiosity is variable over time, that these patients, as I said just said, oscillate between grandiosity, that is arrogance, entitlement, exploitativeness, and vulnerability. They're extremely hypersensitive, they can be very socially avoidant, and they're very shame-prone. So grandiosity is an unstable trait with these patients. A recent study using daily diary cards indicated that pathological narcissism predicted fluctuations within the individual of grandiose and vulnerable narcissistic strategies to navigate social interaction over the course of a week. So in other words, when these individuals, and they were given daily diary cards to fill out, but there have also been studies when patients actually every couple of hours or when they have a social interaction record on a cell phone or an iPad what their feelings are. And so we know that grandiosity tends to fluctuate according to the perceived communal responses of others during social interactions. So NPD individuals are highly reactive to social interaction. They crave admiration and approval, and when they don't get it, they're likely to flip over into a vulnerable state very quickly. So the conclusion for this is that individuals identified by the grandiose criteria privileged by the DSM-4-5 are likely to have vulnerable manifestations of the disorder as well. And what we find with these patients is greater pathology of relatedness that's masked by their more stable functioning, and that makes it difficult to see the insecure attachment patterns and their impact on self and interpersonal functioning that often bring these patients to treatment, NPD patients to treatment. So let me describe to you one typical patient from our study. This is a single 35-year-old unemployed female, the middle daughter from a highly educated immigrant family, many unsuccessful treatments, 3 brief hospitalizations. The mother was controlling and at times depressed, had bouts of suicidality previously during the patient's childhood. The father was neglecting or pressuring to achieve and had engaged in inappropriate sexual behavior with the patient. For 6 months before starting TFP, she was isolated in her apartment, binge eating, rarely bathing, with chronic suicidal ideation and occasional self-cutting. She had very poor interpersonal relations and near total withdrawal from others. Very severe sexual inhibition, had had no sexual relations ever, dropped out from a prestigious college and held a series of jobs destroyed by her belligerent and demeaning behavior. And she had not been working for the past few years before coming into a TFP treatment in the study. At admission to the study, she met criteria for BPD, NPD, and avoidant personality on the International Personality Disorder Exam, Armin Loringer's measure, at admission. Now, in our view, there are multiple vectors that combine to produce narcissistic personality disorder. There's much less research on this than there is on BPD as a biopsychosocial disorder, but it looks like NPD is also a biopsychosocial disorder. From an object relations point of view, we focus on the grandiose self, and that's a self structure that combines ideal self-representations, ideal representations of others with the real self. And this is superimposed on a split structure. And I'll go into that in a minute. Added to that, there are insecure, disorganized attachment, working models of attachment. And this is what our research is about specifically. Also deficits in social cognition. A number of studies that Elsa Roningstam and her colleagues have reviewed show that these individuals have specific kinds of deficits in empathy. They have deficits in emotional empathy, that they cannot feel what others feel, they can't resonate with the feelings of others, but not in cognitive empathy. They're actually able to understand the thoughts, feelings, and motivations at a cognitive level of others and of themselves. However, they have a tendency to do what Fonagy and Bateman have called hypermentalization. So they can't stop mentalizing, and it's often used in the interest of manipulating other people because they're so dependent on the admiration of others. So they have this kind of mentalization that seems like genuine mentalization, but it's actually a kind of compulsive-driven mentalization. Then there are developmental experiences. Now, I should say the research on this is minimal, and it's very contradictory. Clinicians will report that NPD patients show a parenting profile of over-involved parents who also use the child as an extension of the self. So they both are over-involved but also exploit the child. There's also some literature that shows these individuals have abuse and neglect in their histories. But then there are other studies which actually show that there's no consistent pattern of parenting for narcissistic personality disorder, which, by the way, seems to be on the rise. The most recent study shows that this is becoming a more prevalent disorder. I think in a community study done by Stinson and his colleagues, it was something like 6 point, I think it's about 6% of the population in a community study. And that's risen from about 2% of the population or 1% of the population in previous studies. So it's kind of, I think, a very interesting question. Why is this type of disorder on the rise? And again, we can take that up in the discussion period. From an object relations point of view, we see the underpinnings of narcissistic pathology is of those who have a pathological grandiose self. So this is a compensatory structure. It has a condensation of ideal separate representations, ideal representations of others, condensed with the real self. This provides a semblance of integration, mass split psychological structure, all negative, if everything ideal is combined with the real self, then all negative representations need to be projected. So others then are seen in the light of the devalued self and object representations. And at the same time, this is unstable because the individual requires those devalued others to admire and mirror the self. So there's a constant instability in this grandiosity. Grandiosity, however, can also lead to a retreat from the world of object relations. So these patients often are not fully grounded in reality, and that, I think, is a very underestimated aspect of their disorder. They have fluctuations in their reality testing, which are often come out of the blue because they seem to be more stable. You have some cartoons here. I always think that the New Yorker is particularly brilliant at showing different types and levels of narcissistic pathology. I'll just let you enjoy those on your own. But what I do want to point out is that they actually show the different levels of narcissistic disorders. So I'll be glad when his genius grant runs out, shows somebody who's a higher functioning NPD individual. Call it unity, call it narcissism, call it egomania. I love you. The second cartoon shows an individual who clearly has more severe distortions in the way they experience and represent themselves. And then the final cartoon, that's it, I'm returning those narcissists to get to today, shows a man who's actually cutting everything around him, bushes, creating sculptures in order to fit the self-image, and that shows much more severe distortions of reality in line with what we call malignant narcissism, which is a type of narcissistic pathology that combines not only a pathological grandiose self, but one that's infused with aggression, paranoia, and antisocial features. Okay, So object relations theory offers a conceptualization of NPD that ties together the descriptive features at different levels of severity. The major focus is on the organization and quality of internal representations of self and others. And this helps us to understand and empathize with the subjective experience of individuals with NPD. I want to say that our way of thinking about this, which is that we have these core domains of identity, defenses, reality testing, object relations, moral functioning, and the expression and modulation of aggressive affects. And thinking about these as different dimensions of narcissistic pathology that one might have more or less severity of pathology on, I think is very consistent with the view of personality disorders in Section 3 of the DSM-5. And again, I'm going to not go over each of these slides, you have them to refer to, but Section 3 puts new emphasis on structures and mechanisms related to impairments of self and interpersonal functioning in the domains of identity, intimacy, and self-direction. And we know that Bender and Skodal have written that maladaptive patterns of mentally representing self and others serve as a substrate for personality psychopathology and traits, including NPD. And these conceptualizations are common to a wide range of theories, not just psychodynamic, but also CBT, interpersonal schema-focused therapy. Okay, so let me now get to the attachment research. What does attachment research tell us about narcissistic pathology? Well, Bowlby believed that the attachment behavioral system was a hardwired, inborn system that served to protect the individual from danger by assuring that he or she maintains proximity to caring and supportive others. And these others became a person's attachment figures. I want to say that there's also a corresponding caregiving system. So we're hardwired that when the individual who is an attachment figure seeks care, the caregiver is also, because of their basic affect wiring and so on, is programmed in a sense to give care. So Bowlby believed that attachment theory and research would contribute to our understanding and treatment of severe personality disorders in a number of ways. He linked different disorders with different types of attachment, and this is just based on his own clinical observation. Early on in 1978, he linked narcissistic disorders with avoidant dismissing internal working models of attachment, and he believed that these types of attachment patterns derived from experiences of attachment figures as consistently rejecting and or emotionally unavailable. And he believed that such individuals would attempt to live their lives without the love and support of others and to be diagnosed narcissistic. So we decided to do a study where we would look at data on borderline patients from two international randomized clinical trials. One was of TFP versus DBT versus supportive treatment, and that was done in New York at Cornell under the leadership of John Clark and Ken Levy and colleagues. And the second one is of TFP versus treatment by experienced therapists in the community, and that was done by Stefan During, Anna Buchheim, and their colleagues in Vienna and Munich. And we had comparable data sets in these two studies, that is, comparable participants, procedures, assessment instruments. So what I'm going to present to you today is the cross-sectional data that we have from admission to the study. We're right now in the process of doing a longitudinal study where we're looking at change in the NPD patients, NPD-BPD patients, and how they change over the course of TFP, and comparing that with how the BPD patients change in the course of TFP. But this particular data that I'm going to present to you is just baseline data. We used the adult attachment interview to assess internal working models of attachment, and you all are probably familiar with this. It's a semi-structured interview to assess the individual's representations of self in relation to attachment figures. It's designed to surprise the unconscious. It's rated for attachment classification and reflective functioning. And it really captures modes of discourse, defense, and affect regulation in the language through a particular type of coding system. It's 18 questions asked in set order with standardized probes, and we give it at the beginning of treatment and at 1 year. I'm going to briefly introduce you to the scoring system. There are five different classifications used to score the AAI. Secure, and those are people who speak in a free and autonomous way with respect to their early attachment experiences and relationships. They have ready access to attachment-related memories. They articulate these in a coherent and organized way. Preoccupied, enmeshed states of mind with respect to attachment figures with whom one remains emotionally entangled. There's often oscillation between positive and negative valuations of attachment figures. So you'll recognize there a lot of borderline patients actually are classified as preoccupied. Although these categories were developed on a normative sample of parents and children by Mary Maid and her colleagues at Berkeley. The dismissing classification are those who are devaluing or idealizing of attachment figures, and yet when they're asked to give specific examples of these idealized figures, they are not able to give convincing evidence, and they often have lack of recall for early attachment-related experiences and memories. In cannot classify state of mind, you have oscillation between two or more opposing attachment states of mind, going back and forth between dismissing and preoccupied throughout the interview, or one shifts in the course of the interview strategy from mother to father, so that one could be very dismissing towards the mother and preoccupied with father. We're going to see an example of that later on. Unresolved for loss or abuse, these individuals show lapses in the monitoring of reasoning and discourse in response to questions about loss and abuse. And again, this the very typical codes or classifications for borderline patients are preoccupied and unresolved. For narcissistic patients, they are usually dismissing. So previous research has linked NPD with the dismissing avoidant attachment, but also there's some studies that have been done that show that there's a subset of men that show preoccupied anxious attachment. And then in our research, we've actually found that there are NPD patients who have disorganized attachment, unresolved or cannot classify. And I should just mention that there are two different ways to think about attachment. There's secure versus insecure. So in other words, somebody can be secure on the AI. They have an organized strategy for approaching the interview. And they can be insecure organized. They can be insecure, but they still approach the interview in an organized way. They're either preoccupied or dismissing. The disorganized categories are those where the person shows a lot of disfluency in the language, inability to approach the interview with an organized attachment strategy. And so many, many individuals with borderline pathology have a primary classification of disorganized, whereas those with anxiety disorders and other types and depression tend to be either dismissing or preoccupied. Okay, so let me just focus a little bit more on what dismissing AI narratives show, since we're really looking here at the NPD individuals, and this is the primary attachment category that has been found in research today. So those who show dismissing speakers on the AI have active derogating dismissal or brittle idealization of attachment-related experiences. They tend to valorize their personal strengths and autonomy. They often have a cool, contemptuous attitude toward attachment figures who are seen as foolish, inferior, or contemptible. And we think that those with dismissing attachment have two conflicting sets of representations, a dominant idealized or devalued model of self in relation to others, and a model of self as unworthy based on experiences of rejection or lack of care. So while they tend to have, at the conscious level, a dominant either idealized or devalued model, unconsciously, these are often people who have experienced rejection or lack of care, and that's the level that's so difficult to get to in treatment. We also find that those with NPD have deficits in mentalization, as I mentioned. It's very difficult for them to decenter from the grandiose self, to really take in, to see their own grandiosity as just a state of mind and not as the total reality of who they are. And that, of course, then limits the extent to which they can show emotional empathy for others. Although, as I mentioned earlier, they do tend to hypermentalize and to have quite elaborate theories about the minds of others in order to sometimes in the service of manipulating them. So in our study, we actually evaluated mentalization through the reflective functioning scale. And this is a scale, again, you have a slide on this. It goes from -1, these are anti-reflective, hostile, active evasion of reflection, through scale 0.3, low or questionable RF, and 3 is indicative of naive, simplistic, or over-analytic reasoning, and it's the one that's usually seen in borderline states. And then we have, at the higher levels, marked, sophisticated understanding of mental states. So let me just move a little more quickly now to our study so we can get to some of the clinical material here. So we expected that patients with NPD-BPD would be more likely to be classified as dismissing or cannot classify on the AI, and we expected these patients with BPD to be classified, more likely to be classified as preoccupied or unresolved on the AI, and we expected them both to have low reflective functioning. And that, of course, is because NPD has been associated with lack of empathy and disinterest in understanding others, and BPD with deficits in reflective capacity, often linked to lack of resolution of trauma. In terms of our sample, I'm not going to go through the details of the sample. Just to say that given our hypotheses, you have a slide on that, any questions I can answer during the question period. But given our hypothesis that the NPD-BPD patients would be more likely to be classified as dismissing or cannot classify, and the BPD patients would be more likely to be classified as preoccupied or unresolved, we regrouped our attachment categories because we had a fairly small N, and we regrouped these into dismissing plus cannot classify versus all other AI classifications for the NPD-BPD group and preoccupied plus unresolved categories versus all other AI classifications for the BPD group. And you have a slide which shows our data. So as expected, we found that the NPD-BPD patients were nearly twice as likely as the BPD patients to receive a primary AI classification of dismissing or cannot classify, and also that the BPD diagnostic group was more likely to have unresolved or preoccupied attachment classification than was the NPD-BPD group. So our hypotheses were confirmed. We also found low RF in both groups as we expected. So let me just give you now a summary of our findings. The NPD-BPD group was more likely to be classified as dismissing or cannot classify. The BPD group more likely to be classified as preoccupied or unresolved. And let me give you some examples going back to our case of the NPD-BPD patient. This is an example of a dismissing state of mind. She's asked now to describe her mother, and she says, I only say it's a weak bond because when you're asking me about remembering about my mother, it's difficult for me to remember because I don't remember bonding with my mother. I swear to God, it was like being with a schoolmaster. That's what it feels like. So here you see she describes her mother with an attitude of cool, active devaluation and derogation. She can't recall in any significant detail any autobiographical memories to support her general description, so it's a very restricted narrative. On the other hand, she describes her father with a kind of preoccupied state of mind. I don't know. I didn't feel bonded to him. I don't remember my father. I swear to God I don't. I remember he kind of joked around with us, you know, especially with me. And I don't know if this makes sense. I don't know, like, the concept of dad and father. You don't understand what that means. And my father would, like, play with me or tickle me, and I would run away scared, but I felt some sort of a sexual thing. I know it sounds weird. I know I felt this feeling of wanting to masturbate. That is the truth. And I told this to Dr. K, my former therapist, at a really, really, really early age. So I felt this sort of sexual thing with my father, and I was scared of him. So here, the description is very different. It shows current preoccupation involving anger and fear. The discourse is incoherent and confused. It's an uncontained narrative, as opposed to the description of the mother, which was a constricted, overly contained narrative. So this individual was classified as cannot classify on the AI. And here's another example of how you see oscillation between dismissing devaluation and preoccupation with attachment figures. So you want me to say adjectives? That's not a fair question. You know, I mean, of course I'm going to say loving and kind because I love them. Do you want to say that then? This is from the interviewer. You know what? You better erase loving because I don't remember that. I just know I loved her, but I don't remember being in a loving relationship. It was more like I'm the teacher, you're the student, do as I say, that type of thing. It was controlling, I would say. So you erase loving, right? Well, I want to say it because, I mean, is there anyone who doesn't feel love for their parent? Or, you know, I mean, you feel something, you know. I mean, I did love them, you know. I mean, but you want to know how? So you see she's going back and forth between this constricted, dismissing state of mind and then a preoccupied, incoherent, where the discourse is incoherent, is fluent. There's oscillations between positive and negative valuations of the parents and run-on sentences that have no closure. An example of her low RF. Now, this is an individual who had one of the lowest RF scores in the entire sample. It was at time one, it was -1, and an RF is rated according to certain questions on the AI, and this is one of them. How do you think your childhood experiences have affected your adult personality? These questions pull for mentalization. And she says, I think if someone had been in my room, put me to sleep, assured me there was nothing bad going to happen, I think a lot of this stuff would have gone all right. My dad and I, we went to a movie once, and it was a movie about this woman, and I was maybe third or fourth grade, and it was about this woman. She married, she goes to this party, her husband doesn't come with her to the party, and her friend says, well, you know, like this guy, he'll take you home. He doesn't exactly take her home, he rapes her. So she's asked about how childhood experiences have affected her adult personality, and she gives a bizarre, incoherent, inappropriate response to the question. So what are the clinical implications of these research findings? With dismissing status, the focus is continually away from attachment relationships and their influence. The person is shut down, attachment is deactivated. This goes along with grandiose self-states. With preoccupied status, the focus is persistently toward attachment relationships and their influences. There's a hyperactivation of attachment, and it's associated with more vulnerable states. So we see that individuals with NPD-BPD have contradictory defenses, resistances, and transferences. On the one hand, they are dismissing. The therapist is relentlessly devalued. There's an inability to depend. On the other hand, they can shift quite quickly from frail idealization over to frail idealization and then back to complete devaluation of the therapist. They have, as a dismissing speaker, will have no motivation to reflect on in the internal world. They have a slot machine attitude towards therapy. They just want a quick fix. They want to deal with immediate problems. Or in the preoccupied state of mind, there can be excessive rumination on internal states and also excessive rumination on disappointment about their entitled expectations of others. In their dismissing state of mind, they use the therapist as a mirror. They have arrogant dismissal of interpretation. Or in their preoccupied state of mind, they might treat interpretations as oracles from Delphi with very little reflection on them. In dismissing state of mind, rigid, unvarying, constricted narratives, deactivation of affect. But in the preoccupied state of mind, uncontained, chaotic narratives and hyperactivation of affects. So you have this constant oscillation, those who have cannot classify, between dismissing and preoccupied states of mind, and that can be very confusing and off-putting to the therapist. So I just want to highlight that there's really two variants of disorganized attachment for the NPD and BPD groups, the NPD, BPD, and BPD groups. So cannot classify is, as I mentioned, fluctuating states of mind with respect to attachment throughout the interview, oscillation between two or more defensive strategies that are often opposing in nature. The most typical is oscillation between dismissing and preoccupied states of mind. But with the BPD patients and the lack of resolution of loss and trauma, you have a different kind of disorganization. You don't have that oscillation between different opposing states of mind. You have focal drastic collapse in the monitoring of reasoning and discourse involving entrance into peculiar, compartmentalized, and dissociated segregated states of mind around specific questions about childhood loss and abuse. And I'll give you an example here from a BPD patient without NPD. She says that one day I ended up down at the end of the stairs. There was something so Alfred Hitchcock about that moment. I was terrified. Not too many other memories of pure terror like that time. Memories of him being home with my mother. My emotions turned to, I hate you. You disrespect. Why don't you go somewhere and die? But being alone and died. Do you have a specific memory of him pushing you down the stairs? And she says, I remember a foot pushing me. So here you have an example of that sudden intrusion of disorganization, and violence pervades her consciousness, and that parallels the suddenness with which she describes violence perpetrated against her. So she shows much evidence that's typical for the lack of resolution of loss and trauma on the AI, typical lapses in the monitoring of reasoning and discourse, including irregular speech patterns, psychologically confused statements, incoherent speech, the intrusion of visual sensory images. That foot kicking her is an example. Okay, so I want to just give you our conclusions and summary. We think that there may be a stabilizing effect of narcissistic pathology in the context of borderline organization. Why do we think that? Because we find significantly less lack of resolution of loss and trauma, UAAI status, even though we have found, at least in our New York Cornell sample, that there are comparable levels of self-reported trauma. So in other words, in our U.S. sample on the childhood trauma questionnaire, the CTQ, individuals reported comparable levels of trauma if they were NPD, BPD, and BPD, and yet the BPD patients had far more lack of resolution of loss and trauma on the AI than did the NPD patients, significantly more. So dismissing and cannot classify are the most prevalent AI classification for the NPD-BPD patients. Cannot classify is high on idealization, devaluation, and involving anger. We think that narcissistic defenses help to contain the current unresolved anger toward attachment figures. So in other words, in order to be high, in order to get the classification of cannot classify on the AI, one has to be high on subscales of idealization, devaluation, that's one, but also involving anger. So clearly the idealizing, devaluing mechanisms are controlling or containing the involving anger for those particular patients. And therefore they may look more stable, as I mentioned earlier. Dismissing classification is associated with narcissistic defenses, devaluation, idealization, omnipotence, projection, and autistic fantasy. And these give the appearance of resilience in the face of childhood trauma. And by the way, there's a group at Austin Riggs that's been studying defenses in narcissistic patients, and these are the defenses that they have empirically identified through numerous ratings of videotapes of patients, that these patients are higher on devaluation, idealization, omnipotence, projection, autistic fantasy than they are on splitting per se, interestingly enough. I'm not going to go through the limitations of our study. I think you can read over those, and I can answer any questions about those. It has a lot of limitations. It's really a pilot study with a convenient sample, because we did want to look at the NPD, BPD patients just from our existing studies. Now with our most recent study that's coming up, we're going to be much more systematically studying narcissistic pathology, and that's both as it presents itself at the beginning of treatment, how it manifests itself in the TFP therapy situation, and how it affects outcome. Okay, we do believe that TFP is an effective treatment for a spectrum of narcissistic disorders because TFP actually emphasizes both sides of object-relational dyads, the self-pole and the object pole. So we believe with a narcissistic patient, there's a grandiose self-pole, and then with an idealized self, and then there is a devalued other pole. But the individual is really identified with both poles, as is the typical borderline patient, but the grandiose self-structure protects them from recognizing their identification with the devalued objects and devalued self. It takes much longer to get to that. So TFP is designed to address different phenotypic presentations, the different spectrum of insecure, disorganized working models of attachment, and fluctuating mental states. Let me just talk about come back to the patient. So her attachment classification was cannot classify with dismissing and preoccupied states of mind with respect to attachment, as we've just seen. She had the lowest RF rating possible. In the first 3 months of treatment, she dismissed the therapist's interventions with contempt. She criticized him relentlessly for being inadequate and doing nothing for her. She talked nonstop and interrupted the therapist. What I wanted to do is read you. Do I have time, Elena, to read a little bit from a transcript? Elena, are you there?
Yes, I think that'd be really interesting.
Okay, so I'm going to just read you part of the session, because I think it will show how these cannot classify dynamics actually play out in the clinical situation. In this session, the patient, it was 6 months into treatment. She came to the session after making a non-lethal suicide attempt. She insisted that the behavior had nothing to do with the therapist's upcoming vacation. So this is a little bit of dialogue from the session. Therapist, you know everything you're saying. I'm sorry, I actually had a videotape to go with this, but unfortunately I wasn't able to post it for reasons of confidentiality, so I'm going to read you from the transcript. Therapist, you know everything you're saying today I think is geared to have an impact on your relationship with me. The patient says, really? How? I don't know how. And this is after, by the way, that they have processed the non-lethal suicide attempt that the patient made. The therapist has determined that it was not a lethal attempt, and they're trying to explore what it was about. The therapist says, well, maybe we should stop and think about it, the patient. And the therapist says, I think what you're doing here today, the patient says, well, I'd like to talk about something. Why did you say if I already have a therapist, why would I want to look for one? And the therapist says, I think what you're doing here lately is kind of eliminating me more and more, in different ways telling me I'm not important, I'm not helpful. Patient says, you're not. Therapist, that I don't give you what you want. The patient says, you're not helpful, you don't hear what I'm saying. Therapist, I'd like to try to understand why you've escalated that position so much in the last two sessions. Patient, it's not related to your going away. It has nothing to do with that. Therapist, but... Patient, well, it might have a little bit. Yesterday I was drawing a picture. I drew a gun and I drew a head, and that's what I feel like doing. The therapist says, I know. In different ways, you're sort of waving flags at me, telling me that you're worse, I'm useless, I'm not helping you, this is useless. Patient says, well, and you interrupt me, the therapist says. So I think it's a combination of anger at me that I'm not providing you with the kind of total caretaking that you wish for, and my going away underlines that. Patient, I was suicidal before I knew you were going away. I was suicidal that day when I was at my cousin's birthday. Therapist, well, you can continue to reject everything I say before thinking about it. Patient, well, then stop relating everything to your going away because I'm suicidal even when you're here. Therapist, if you just look at today's session and the last one and you do a graph, it's gone up like this. Patient, what? Therapist, your talk of suicide. And I'm going to just skip a little bit here. The therapist says to her, you seem especially quick to reject things today. Patient, I'm not rejecting you. Therapist, but what's going on now is a real dramatic reaction to feeling like you're getting attached to someone. And this is apparently what happens when that process begins. Patient, why should I swallow what you're saying? Therapist, it's for you to decide what to do with it, but you seem to be rejecting it without even thinking about it. Patient, well, you don't know me, and you come up with this stupid theory, and I'm supposed to swallow it. You don't know me. Why should I? And the therapist says, I think that sentence is another reflection of your feeling hurt. You're feeling like you're not getting caring you like, like the type of caring is impossible. You feel like you're an object on an assembly line. The patient has a sudden change of affect here. She turns her head to the side. She puts her head down. She covers her face. She says, I don't feel I deserve to be here. I just feel badly I have to walk around with other human beings. I don't feel like. Therapist, that's more to the point. Why do you think it's so hard for you to show me your face when you say that? Patient, I don't know what else to do. I just don't want you to see me. Therapist, I think you don't want me to see you in the longing you feel. You don't mind if I see you in your anger and your rejection. You don't want me to see the longing because you think I'll just use that to humiliate you by rejecting, by turning away from you. Patient, and how does that translate into how I take care of myself? I didn't take a bath. I didn't brush my teeth. I spent thousands of dollars on my teeth, and you know how it's translated into, therapist, it translates into how you don't take care of yourself. Patient, how? What's the connection between when I say to you, I don't want you to see me? How is that connected to my self-image that I feel I'm really disgusting? Therapist, since you say that rejection is inevitable, you try to control it. You may come across to people as totally disgusting, though you don't succeed as it. You may try to come across to people as totally disgusting, though you don't succeed at it very well, but you just keep saying you are. Patient, you mean because I think that rejection is inevitable, I try to confirm it by dressing this way? Therapist, you feel you've got to control it. You say, I'm making him reject me, so it doesn't feel so bad if I'm the one who's in charge. Patient, yeah, I just feel like the tragedy of everything, of all of this, is that I have help available. I have people like you and like Bob. He's really caring. This is her boss. He doesn't really understand, but he doesn't understand anything. And then she goes on to say, you're actually working with me with tangible things, things I've told you that actually happened. This therapy is different from other therapy. We're dealing with concrete things. We're not just splitting theory and stuff that happens in old-style therapy. My therapy with you is just a little different. It's more geared to who I am and making me active, getting into the next state. You have an insight, but need to make it work. Make it work for yourself. Therapist, your whole tone changed here a few minutes ago. Did you notice that? Patient, yes. Therapist, how did you understand that? You mean now we're talking with more of a dialogue? Therapist, yes, and you seem less angry. Patient, well, in the waiting room, my fantasy was that the room had all your patients and that you came out and said hi to me, and I just ignored you, and then you said, didn't you hear me say hi? And I said yes, and I was very cold to you, and then everyone else was staring at me, like angry with me, and I just stared right back at them. I didn't care. And then one person said, that's not nice to do, and I told them to shut the fuck up. Therapist, so your fantasy was patient humiliating you. Therapist, humiliating me? Patient, I want that fantasy to happen. Therapist, why would you want to humiliate me? patient, why not? I was humiliated. Why shouldn't I humiliate you? I have to deal with it all my life, every single day. Therapist, I think we should look at something a little closer to home right now. I think my going away may be the humiliation you're experiencing right now. Patient, no. Yes, I guess there's a longing in a way, because I did come on time today. I really did want to come, and I do long to come here. I guess I do. And it's not the same thing between seeing her former therapist and you. I'm more attached to you than I was to him. He was, but it's not the same. It isn't. It's who you are. I like you more. I remember this boy in camp. There weren't many students like me there. I was one of the only ones. I used to look at him. I never thought he'd speak to me. No one looked at me, or if they did, I could tell they thought I was strange. So I just keep to myself, except that when I thought they were talking to me, I'd let them have it. But one day, this boy sat down next to me. Okay. So, in that, I know that's a lot to listen to and take in, but I'll just point out that in that segment of the session, necessarily brief, you do see this oscillation between dismissing and preoccupied states of mind, and that's evident in the shift from her devaluing statements, her dismissing her dependency on him, her reluctance to engage in self-disclosure, her contempt for him, her desire to humiliate him, and then flipping over then into her preoccupied state of mind, talking about dependency on the therapist, oscillating between positive and negative evaluations of him, immersion in current involving anger at the therapist. So you see this oscillation between the devaluing and the dismissing and the preoccupied states of mind, I think, in the clinical process. So, again, I'm going to just skip a little bit here and just say that TFP for NPD, I think, is effective because, first of all, we have empathy for the retreat of these patients. These patients can be in a kind of psychic retreat that John Steiner will talk about in his book, Psychic Retreats. There's so much pain in getting in touch with their subjective experience. They hide behind the grandiose self. In TFP, we see the projected devalued aspects of the self onto the therapist, and the therapist has to then hold that devaluation, model for the patient that they can tolerate the patient seeing them as a devaluated object, that they can tolerate being seen and experienced as imperfect, the very thing that the patient themselves can't tolerate. So the neutrality in TFP, recognizing that the attacks that these patients levy on the therapist really come from their own devalued sense of self. We pay attention to the details of external reality, and we discover through examining what goes on in external relationships and external reality, what are the transference dynamics? So what we're going for is a dismantling of the grandiose self, the emergence of the patient from the retreat, with that the emergence of specific self-object dyads or disparate internal working models of attachment, humiliator, humiliated, controlling person, controlled other, superior self, humiliated therapist as in the dismissing state of mind, the devalued self, the rejecting therapist as in the preoccupied state of mind. So with the dissolution of the grandiose self, you have the emergence of these very specific self and object representations that are alternately enacted and projected into the therapeutic situation. And it can get quite chaotic. I just want to mention that with this particular case, this was quite a successful case. We had improvement in her RF score from total repudiation of any reflection on mental states to clear, explicit capacity to think about her own and others' behavior in terms of intentional mental states. So she actually had a 6 in reflective functioning, went from a -1 to a 6, which is quite high. Some of our therapists barely got that when I looked at their reflective functioning, so she really made tremendous progress in that way. She also shifted from disorganized to organized attachment on the AI, from cannot classify with dismissing and preoccupied states of mind to an organized preoccupied state of mind, the angry conflicted subtype. And this, by the way, mirrors some of the actual findings that have been done previously. Andy Gerber did a study with Peter Fonagy in which they looked at a group of severely personality disordered individuals over the course of 18 months of treatment, and they actually found that individuals who started out as dismissing or secure, some of them were actually secure, as are some of our patients, a very small number of them, those individuals after 6 to 12 months actually did look preoccupied. So there's a trajectory that you can see in long-term treatment of these patients of shifting their attachment representations, and then as these individuals approach discharge, in the Gerber study at least, a large proportion of them, significant proportion of them, actually were classified with secure attachment. And we found the same thing actually in our study. We were stunned to find out in one of our studies that actually quite a significant portion of those patients in TFP did shift to security of attachment. Anyway, let me read to you her AI time 2. A statement of RF. She says, I've learned that the world is not as hostile as I thought it was. I've learned people are not two-dimensional. They're three-dimensional, and they want to be treated that way, the way I want to be treated three-dimensionally. I've learned that people don't necessarily abandon you. People can be mad with you for a while, but that doesn't mean they're going to abandon you. It's possible for people to be mad with you and still like you. And then she also, reflecting on what was the impact of her parents' style of parenting on her development, she says, I really didn't live in the real world growing up. I lived in a fantasy world, the way I wanted to see the world. I really didn't interact with the world the way my father didn't interact with me. So I don't think I felt any compassion for people. So we have marked RF evident in the capacity to understand and contextualize her behavior and attitudes in terms of intentional mental states and to reflect on their developmental origins. So I'll just end by saying that the TFP is now an evidence-based treatment, according to Division 12, pending further research, which we're doing now. As we are writing a manual for TFP for NPD, we will be doing in our next study some research specifically on NPD. And I'll just sum up by saying that these findings, I hope, contribute to understanding the different representational processes, modes of affect regulation and defense that characterize the diverse contradictory attachment strategies associated with NPD-BPD patients. And they help us to illuminate the shifts in mental states between dismissing and preoccupied, grandiose and vulnerable as the attachment system is activated in the clinical situation. Okay. It's a lot of territory in 1 hour. So, thank you.
Thank you so much, Diana. I really appreciate it. And I know that many of the people listening also did. I know we're a little bit over, but maybe we have time for one question. one question that came in was, what advice would you give a spouse or parents who believe that their loved one has BPD, NPD?
Well, the first thing that I think is really important is proper diagnosis. And diagnosing NPD is very, very difficult. Often you have misdiagnosis, focus on depression, because these patients can get very depressed when their grandiosity is punctured. So the first thing I would do is make sure that you're diagnosed properly, and that is difficult. I mean, the DSM criteria, as I said, are flawed. So proper diagnosis is one thing. The second thing is proper treatment. It's astonishing how it just, as there is a problem with treating borderline, and people just not trained, many people not trained to treat personality disorders, this is particularly the case with NPD. So I would certainly want that person to be in treatment with somebody who has experience, maybe someone who's written about NPD, has trained with people who understand NPD. The third thing is couples work. Couples work actually can be very effective with NPD, BPD patients and their partners or families. We also treat couples, both who have borderline members of the couple, but also narcissistic. And one of the things that you try to do in the couples work is really to focus on improving the person's capacity to understand in a genuine way the mental states of the spouse and what the impact is of their behavior on that person. They're often quite oblivious to that. And also to understand the ways in which they project the devalued aspects of the self onto the other. This is a very typical pattern, and it's very pervasive and difficult to recognize. But over time, working both with the individual and the couple, I have seen people really make enormous progress with this and really be able to take back those projections and really grapple with their own sense of vulnerability and inferiority and fear of exposure.
Well, thank you so much, Perry. Diana. I wanted to pass along an email that we got, not a question, but just a comment on this presentation. Diana Diamond is, as always, terrific. So challenging to work with NPD, and this presentation illuminates the value and efficacy of TFP. And this listener appreciated your clinical vignette, specifically saying that they brought NPD to life and that this was her favorite presentation this round. So I think that echoes what a lot of us feel. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the comment. Elena? Hi. There's an echo. Well, tell that person, whoever wrote in that comment, thank you very much. I appreciate it very much, and I'm sorry we didn't have more time for questions and discussion.
Well, thank you very much. And this, like all of our presentations, this will be posted on the website, and along with the handouts.
Okay.
And please join us for our next call on April 12th with Kenneth Silk, MD, and the presentation will be entitled Ask the Doctor, Medication, and More. And thank you again, Diana.
Okay, you're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.